To give an example of what this might look like in a given year, in 2012, developing countries received $1.3 trillion, including all income, aid, and investment. But that same year, more than $3.3 trillion flowed out. In other words, according to anthropologist Jason Hickel, developing countries sent $2 trillion more to the rest of the world than they received. When all the flows were added up from 1960 to 2017, a grim truth emerged. $62 trillion was drained out of the developing world. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I am your narrator and professor of Bitcoin for you today. We are actually just going to go ahead and jump right into this because we're diving back into how the IMF and World Bank represses poor countries. The new piece by Alex Gladstein, and it's thorough, extremely thorough piece. And like I said, there's going to be like, I think, three or four parts to this. Do you get through the recording? We're diving into part four, the debt trap. However, if you listen to part one yesterday or the day before, whenever, and you notice that the guy's take was not there, something happened with the upload or the export. I don't know. Something funky happened. I have re-uploaded it. So if you want to listen to the guy's take, I think it was only like 20 minutes, but it was good, and I think it will be relevant to the stuff that we're digging into in part two here. So if you want to listen to it, delete the show from your podcast app and then try to play it again, and it will re-download, and then you can just skip to the 36 or 37 minute mark and just listen to it from there. So with that, let's go ahead and dive back into Gladstein's piece. I want to say thank you to our lovely sponsors really fast. Swan Bitcoin, Fold, and CoinKite have been supporting this show, and also they are products and services that are literally kind of at the center of everything that I do in Bitcoin. And I gotta say, it's been awesome working with them because they don't put any stipulations on me. They just say, we want to support the show, talk about how much you like our products. And it's like, well, that's super easy. So Swan Bitcoin is onboarding to Swan. I mean, onboarding to Bitcoin. If you're looking to get into Bitcoin, just go to Swan Bitcoin. Seriously, don't waste time with anything else. Start there. Fold app is, you can get discount gift cards and sats back on basically everything that you do in fiat. And CoinKite, obviously, has the cold card, has the open dime, has just a plethora of amazing Bitcoin hardware wallet and security solutions. So check them out. They got links right there in the show notes. I'm happy to answer any questions. You know, shoot me a DM or anything. But I think you'll like them, because I do. Details in the show notes. All right. Let's dive into today's read. Part 2 of Gladstein's piece on how the IMF and World Bank repress poor countries. And we're beginning on the section titled Part 4, The Debt Trap. The concept of the Third World or the South and the policy of official aid are inseparable. They are two sides of the same coin. The Third World is the creation of the foreign aid. Without foreign aid, there is no Third World. Peter Tomas Bauer. According to the World Bank, its objective is to, quote, help raise living standards in developing countries by channeling financial resources from developed countries to the developing world. But what if the reality is the opposite? At first, beginning in the 1960s, there was an enormous flow of resources from rich countries to poor ones. This was ostensibly done to help them develop. Payer writes that it was long considered natural for capital to, quote, flow in one direction, only from the developed industrial economies to the third world. But as she reminds us, at some point the borrower has to pay more to his creditor than he has received from the creditor, and over the life of the loan, this excess is much higher than the amount that was originally borrowed. In global economics, this point happened in 1982, when the flow of resources permanently reversed. Ever since, there has been an annual net flow of funds from poor countries to rich ones. This began as an average of $30 billion per year flowing from south to north in the mid-late 1980s, and is today in the range of trillions of dollars per year. Between 1970 and 2007, from the end of the gold standard to the Great Financial Crisis, the total debt service paid by poor countries to rich ones was $7.15 trillion. To give an example of what this might look like in a given year, in 2012, developing countries received $1.3 trillion, including all income, aid, and investment. But that same year, more than $3.3 trillion flowed out. In other words, according to anthropologist Jason Hickel, quote, developing countries sent $2 trillion more to the rest of the world than they received. When all the flows were added up from 1960 to 2017, a grim truth emerged. $62 trillion was drained out of the developing world, the equivalent of 620 Marshall Plans in today's dollar. The IMF and World Bank were supposed to fix balance of payments issues and help poor countries grow stronger and more sustainable. The evidence has been the direct opposite. Quote, for every $1 of aid that developing countries receive, Hickel writes, they lose $24 in net outflows. Instead of ending exploitation and unequal exchange, studies show that structural adjustment policies grew them in a massive way. Since 1970, the external public debt of developing countries has increased from $46 billion to $8.7 trillion. In the past 50 years, countries like India and the Philippines and the Congo now owe their former colonial masters 189 times the amount they owed in 1970. They have paid $4.2 trillion on interest payments alone since 1980. Even Payer, whose 1974 book, The Debt Trap, used economic flow data to show how the IMF ensnared poor countries by encouraging them to borrow more than they could possibly pay back, would be shocked at the size of today's debt trap. Her observation that, quote, the average citizen of the U.S. or Europe may not be aware of this enormous drain in capital from parts of the world they think of as being pitifully poor, still rings true today. To this author's own shame, he did not know about the true nature of the global flow of funds and simply assumed that rich countries subsidized poor ones before embarking on the research for this project. The end result is a literal Ponzi scheme, where by the 1970s, third world debt was so big that it was only possible to service with new debt. It has been the same ever since. Many critics of the bank and fund assume that these institutions are working with their heart in the right place, and when they do fail, it is because of mistakes, waste, or mismanagement. It is the thesis of this essay that this is not true, and that the foundational goals of the fund and bank are not to fix poverty, but rather to enrich creditor nations at the expense of poor ones. This author is simply not willing to believe that a permanent flow of funds from poor countries to rich ones since 1982 is a mistake. The reader may dispute that the arrangement is intentional, and rather may believe it is an unconscious structural outcome. The difference hardly matters to billions of people the bank and fund have impoverished. Part 5. Replacing the Colonial Resource Drain. I am so tired of waiting. Aren't you? for the world to become good and beautiful and kind. Let us take a knife and cut the world in two and see what worms are eating at the rind. Langston Hughes. By the end of the 1950s, Europe and Japan had largely recovered from war and resumed significant industrial growth, while third world countries ran out of funds. Despite having healthy balance sheets in the 1940s and 1950s, poor, raw material exporting countries ran into balance of payments issues as the value of their commodities tanked in the wake of the Korean War. This is when the debt trap began, and when the bank and fund started the floodgates of what would end up becoming trillions of dollars of lending. This also marked the official end of colonialism, as European empires drew back from their imperial possessions. The establishment assumption in international development is that the economic success of nations is due, quote, primarily to their internal domestic conditions. High-income countries have achieved economic success. The theory goes, because of good governance, strong institutions, and free markets, lower-income countries have failed to develop because they lack these things, or because they suffer from corruption, red tape, and inefficiency. This is certainly true, but another major reason why rich countries are rich and poor countries are poor is that the former looted the latter for hundreds of years during the colonial period. Britain's Industrial Revolution, Jason Hickel writes, depended in large part on cotton, which was grown on land forcibly appropriated from indigenous Americans, with labor appropriated from enslaved Africans. Other crucial inputs required by British manufacturers, hemp, timber, iron, grain, were produced using forced labor on serf estates in Russia and Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, British extraction from India and other colonies funded more than half the country's domestic budget, paying for roads, public buildings, the welfare state, all the markets of modern development, while enabling the purchase of material inputs necessary for industrialization. The theft dynamic was described by Utsa and Prabhat Patnaik in their book Capital and Imperialism. Colonial powers like the British Empire would use violence to extract raw materials from weak countries, creating a, quote, colonial drain of capital that boosted and subsidized life in London, Paris, and Berlin. Industrial nations would transform these raw materials into manufactured goods and sell them back to weaker nations, profiting massively while also crowding out local production, and critically, they would keep inflation at home down by suppressing wages in the colonial territories. Either through outright slavery or through paying well below the global market rate. As the colonial system began to falter, the Western financial world faced a crisis. The Patnaiks argue that the Great Depression was a result not simply of changes in the Western monetary policy, but also of the colonial drain slowing down. The reasoning is simple. Rich countries had built a conveyor belt of resources flowing from poor countries, and when the belt broke, so did everything else. Between the 1920s and 1960s, political colonialism became virtually extinct. Britain, the US, Germany, France, Japan, the Netherlands, Belgium, and other empires were forced to give up control over more than half of the world's territory and resources. As the Patnaiks wrote, imperialism is, quote, an arrangement for imposing income deflation on the third world population in order to get their primary commodities without running into the problem of increasing supply price. Post-1960, this became the new function for the World Bank and IMF, recreating the colonial drain from poor countries to rich countries that was once maintained by straightforward imperialism. Officials in the US, Europe, and Japan wanted to achieve internal equilibrium, in other words, full employment. But they realized they could not do this via subsidy inside an isolated system, or else inflation would run rampant. To achieve their goal would require external input from poor countries. The extra surplus value extracted by the core from workers in the periphery is known as imperialist rent. If industrial countries could get cheaper materials and labor, and then sell the finished goods back at a profit, they could inch closer to the technocrat dream economy. And they got their wish, As of 2019, wages paid to workers in the developing world were 20% the level of wages paid to workers in the developed world. As an example of how the bank recreated the colonial drain dynamic, Payer gives the classic case of 1960s Mauritania in northwest Africa. A mining project called Mafirma was signed by French occupiers before the colony became independent. The deal eventually became, quote, just an old-fashioned enclave project, a city in a desert and a railroad leading to the ocean, as the infrastructure was solely focused on spiriting minerals away to international markets. In 1969, when the mine accounted for 30% of Mauritania's GDP and 75% of its exports, 72% of the income was sent abroad. And, quote, practically all the income distributed locally to employees evaporated in imports. When the miners protested against the neo-colonial arrangement, security forces savagely put them down. Mafirma is a stereotypical example of the kind of, quote, development that would be imposed on the Third World, everywhere from the Dominican Republic to Madagascar to Cambodia. And all of these projects rapidly expanded in the 1970s, thanks to the petrodollar system. Post-1973, Arab OPEC countries with enormous surpluses from skyrocketing oil prices sank their profits into deposits and treasuries in Western banks, which needed a place to lend out their growing resources. Military dictators across Latin America, Africa, and Asia made great targets. They had high time preferences and were happy to borrow against future generations. Helping expedite loan growth was the IMF put. Private banks started to believe, correctly, that the IMF would bail out countries if they defaulted, protecting their investments. Moreover, interest rates in the mid-1970s were often in negative real territory, further encouraging borrowers. This, combined with World Bank President Robert McNamara's insistence that assistance expand dramatically, resulted in a debt frenzy. U.S. banks, for example, increased their Third World loan portfolio by 300% to $450 billion between 1978 and 1982. The problem was that these loans were in large part floating interest rate agreements. And a few years later, those rates exploded as the U.S. Federal Reserve raised the global cost of capital close to 20%. The growing debt burden, combined with the 1979 oil price shock and the ensuing global collapse in the price of commodities that power the value of developing country exports, paved the way for the Third World debt crisis. To make matters worse, very little of the money borrowed by governments during the debt frenzy was actually invested in the average citizen. In their aptly named book, Debt Squads, investigative journalists Sue Branford and Bernardo Kosinski explain that between 1976 and 1981, Latin governments, of which 18 of 21 were dictatorships, borrowed $272.9 billion. Out of that, 91.6% was spent on debt servicing, capital flight, and building up regime reserves. Only 8.4% was used on domestic investment, and even out of that, much was wasted. Brazilian civil society advocate Carlos Ayuda vividly described the effect of the petrodollar-fueled drain on his own country. The military dictatorship used the loans to invest in huge infrastructure projects, particularly energy projects. The idea behind creating an enormous hydroelectric dam and plant in the middle of the Amazon, for example, was to produce aluminum for export to the north. The government took out huge loans and invested billions of dollars in building the Tucuri Dam in the late 1970s, destroying native forests and removing massive numbers of native peoples and poor rural people that had lived there for generations. The government would have razed the forests, but the deadlines were so short they used Agent Orange to defoliate the region and then submerge the leafless tree trunks underwater. The hydroelectric plant's energy was then sold at $13 to $20 per megawatt when the actual price of production was $48. So the taxpayers provided subsidies, financing cheap energy for transnational corporations to sell our aluminum in the international market. In other words, the Brazilian people paid foreign creditors for the service of destroying their environment, displacing the masses, and selling their resources. Today, the drain from low and middle income countries is staggering. In 2015, it totaled 10.1 billion tons of raw materials and 182 million person years of labor. 50% of all goods and 28% of all labor used that year by high-income countries. Part 6. A Dance with Dictators.
He may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Of course, it takes two sides to finalize a loan from the bank or fund. The problem is that the borrower is typically an unelected or unaccountable leader who makes the decisions without consulting with and without a popular mandate from their citizens. As Payer writes in The Debt Trap, quote, IMF programs are politically unpopular for the very good concrete reasons that they hurt local business and depress the real income of the electorate. A government which attempts to carry out the conditions in its letter of intent to the IMF is likely to find itself voted out of office. Hence, the IMF prefers to work with undemocratic clients who can more easily dismiss troublesome judges and put down street protests. According to Payer, the military coups in Brazil in 1964, Turkey in 1960, Indonesia in 1966, Argentina in 1966, and the Philippines in 1972 were examples of IMF-opposed leaders being forcibly replaced by IMF-friendly ones. Even if the fund wasn't directly involved in the coup, in each of these cases, it arrived enthusiastically a few days, weeks, or months later to help the new regime implement structural adjustment. The bank and the fund share a willingness to support abusive governments. Perhaps surprisingly, it was the bank that started the tradition. According to development researcher Kevin Danaher,
the bank's sad record of supporting military regimes and governments that openly violated human rights began on August 7, 1947, with a $195 million reconstruction loan to the Netherlands. 17 days before the bank approved the loan, the Netherlands had unleashed a war against anti-colonialist nationalists in its huge overseas empire in the East Indies, which had already declared its independence as the Republic of Indonesia. The Dutch, Danaher writes, sent 145,000 troops from a nation with only 10 million inhabitants at the time, economically struggling at 90% of 1939 production, and launched a total economic blockade of nationalist-held areas, causing considerable hunger and health problems among Indonesia's 70 million inhabitants.
In its first few decades, the bank funded many such colonial schemes, including $28 million for apartheid Rhodesia in 1952, as well as loans to Australia, the United Kingdom, and Belgium to, quote, develop colonial possessions in Papua New Guinea, Kenya, and the Belgian Congo. In 1966, the bank directly defied the United Nations, quote,
continuing to lend money to South Africa and Portugal despite resolutions of the General Assembly calling on all UN-affiliated agencies to cease financial support for both countries, according to Danaher.
Danaher writes that, quote,
Portugal's colonial domination of Angola and Mozambique and South Africa's apartheid were flagrant violations of the UN Charter. But the bank argued that Article 4, Section 10 of its charter, which prohibits interference in the political affairs of any member, legally obliged it to disregard the UN resolutions. As a result, the bank approved loans of $10 million to Portugal and $20 million to South Africa after the UN resolution was passed.
Sometimes the bank's preference for tyranny was stark. It cut off lending to the democratically elected Allende government in Chile in the early 1970s, but shortly after began to lend huge quantities of cash to Ceausescu's Romania, one of the world's worst police states. This is also an example of how the bank and fund, contrary to popular belief, didn't simply lend along Cold War ideological lines. For every right-wing Augusto Pinochet Ugarte or Jorge Rafael Videla client, there was a left-wing Josip Broz Tito, or Julius Nyerere. In 1979, Danaher notes, 15 of the world's most repressive governments would receive a full third of all bank loans. This even after the U.S. Congress and the Carter administration had stopped aid to four of the 15, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, and Ethiopia, for
flagrant human rights violations. Just a few years later, in El Salvador, the IMF made a $43 million loan to the military dictatorship, just a few months after its forces committed the largest massacre in Cold War-era Latin America by annihilating the village of El Mazote. There were several books written about the bank and the fund in 1994, timed as 50-year retrospectives on the Bretton Woods institutions. Perpetuating Poverty by Ian Vasquez and Doug Bandow is one of those studies, and is a particularly valuable one as it provides a libertarian analysis. Most critical studies of the bank and fund are from the left, but the Cato Institute's Vasquez and Bandow saw many of the same problems.
"The fund underwrites any government," they write, "however venal and brutal. China owed the fund $600 million as of the end of 1989, and in January 1990, just a few months after the blood had dried in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, the IMF held a seminar on monetary policy in the city." Vasquez and Bandow mention other tyrannical clients, ranging from military Burma to Pinochet's Chile, Laos, Nicaragua under Anastasio Somoza Debayle and the Sandinistas, Syria, and Vietnam. "The IMF," they say, "has rarely met a dictatorship that it did not like."
Vasquez and Bandow detail the bank's relationship with the Marxist-Leninist Mengistu Haile Mariam regime in Ethiopia, where it provided for as much as 16% of the government's annual budget, while it had one of the worst human rights records in the world. The bank's credit arrived just as Mengistu's forces were, quote, "herding people into concentration camps and collective farms." They also point out how the bank gave the Sudanese regime $16 million while it was driving 750,000 refugees out of Khartoum into the desert, and how it gave hundreds of millions of dollars to Iran, a brutal theocratic dictatorship, and Mozambique, whose security forces were infamous for torture, rape, and summary executions. In his 2011 book, Defeating Dictators, the celebrated Ghanaian development economist George Ayati detailed a long list of aid-receiving autocrats: Paul Biya, Idris Deby, Lansana Conte, Paul Kagame, Yoweri Museveni, Hun Sen, Islam Karimov, Nursultan Nazarbayev, and Emomali Rahmon. He pointed out that the fund had dispensed $75 billion to these nine tyrants alone. In 2014, a report was released by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, alleging that the Ethiopian government had used part of a $2 billion bank loan to forcibly relocate 37,833 indigenous Inuit families. This was 60% of the country's entire Gambela province. Soldiers beat, raped, and killed Inuit who refused to leave their homes. Atrocities were so bad that South Sudan granted refugee status to Inuits streaming in from neighboring Ethiopia. A Human Rights Watch report said that the stolen land was then, quote, leased by the government to investors, and that the bank's money was, quote, used to pay the salaries of government officials who helped carry out the evictions. The bank approved new funding for this villagization program even after allegations of mass human rights violations emerged. It would be a mistake to leave Mobutu Sese Soko's Zaire out of this essay. The recipient of billions of dollars of bank and fund credit during his bloody 32-year reign, Mobutu pocketed 30% of incoming aid and assistance and let his people starve. He complied with 11 IMF structural adjustments. During one in 1984, 46,000 public school teachers were fired and the national currency was devalued by 80%. Mobutu called this austerity, quote, "a bitter pill which we have no alternative but to swallow," but didn't sell any of his 51 Mercedes, any of his 11 chateaus in Belgium or France, or even his Boeing 747 or 16th century Spanish castle. Per capita income declined in each year of his rule on average by 2.2%, leaving more than 80% of the population in absolute poverty. Children routinely died before the age of 5, and swollen belly syndrome was rampant. It was estimated that Mobutu personally stole $5 billion and presided over another $12 billion in capital flight. which together would have been more than enough to wipe the country's $14 billion debt clean at the time of his ouster. He looted and terrorized his people and could not have done it without the bank and fund, which continued to bail him out, even though it was clear he would never repay his debts. That all said, the true poster boy for the bank and fund's affection for dictators might be Ferdinand Marcos. In 1966, when Marcos came to power, the Philippines was the second most prosperous country in Asia, and the country's foreign debt stood at roughly $500 million. By the time Marcos was removed in 1986, the debt stood at $28.1 billion. As Graham Hancock writes in Lords of Poverty, most of these loans, quote, had been contracted to pay for extravagant development schemes which, although irrelevant to the poor, had pandered to the enormous ego of the head of state. A painstaking 2-year investigation established beyond serious dispute that he had personally expropriated and sent out of the Philippines more than $10 billion. Much of this money, which of course should have been at the disposal of the Philippine state and people, had disappeared forever in Swiss bank accounts. $100 million, Hancock writes, was paid for the art collection for Imelda Marcos. Her tastes were eclectic and included 6 old masters purchased from the Knoedler Gallery in New York for $5 million, a Francis Bacon canvas supplied by the Marlborough Gallery in London, and a Michelangelo, Madonna and Child, bought from Mario Bellini in Florence for $3.5 million. During the last decade of the Marcos regime, he says, while valuable art treasuries were being hung on penthouse walls in Manhattan and Paris, the Philippines had lower nutritional standards than any other nation in Asia, with the exception of war-torn Cambodia. To contain popular unrest, Hancock writes that Marcos banned strikes and, quote, union organizing was outlawed in all key industries and in agriculture. Thousands of Filipinos were imprisoned for opposing the dictatorship, and many were tortured and killed. Meanwhile, the country remained consistently listed among the top recipients of both U.S. and World Bank development assistance. After the Filipino people pushed Marcos out, they still had to pay an annual sum of anywhere between 40 and 50% of the entire value of their exports, quote, just to cover the interest on the foreign debts that Marcos incurred. One would think that after ousting Marcos, the Filipino people would not have to owe the debt he incurred on their behalf without consulting them. But that is not how it has worked in practice. In theory, this concept is called odious debt and was invented by the U.S. in 1898 when it repudiated Cuba's debt after Spanish forces were ousted from the island. American leaders determined that debts, quote, incurred to subjugate a people or to colonize them, were not legitimate. But the bank and fund have never followed this precedent during their 75 years of operations. Ironically, the IMF has an article on its website suggesting that Somoza, Marcos, apartheid South Africa, Haiti's, quote, baby doc, and Nigeria's Sani Abachi all borrowed billions illegitimately, and that the debt should be written off for their victims. But this remains a suggestion unfollowed. Technically and morally speaking, a large percentage of third world debt should be considered odious and not owed anymore by the population, should their dictator be forced out. After all, in most cases, the citizens paying back the loans didn't elect their leader and didn't choose to borrow the loans that they took out against their future. In July 1987, the revolutionary leader Thomas Sankara gave a speech to the Organization of African Unity, the OAU, in Ethiopia, where he refused to pay the colonial debt of Burkina Faso and encouraged other African nations to join him. We cannot pay, he said, because we are not responsible for this debt. Sankara famously boycotted the IMF and refused structural adjustment. 3 months after his OAU speech, he was assassinated by Blaise Compaoré, who would install his own 27-year military regime that would receive 4 structural adjustment loans from the IMF and borrow dozens of times from the World Bank for various infrastructure and agriculture projects. Since Sankara's death, few heads of state have been willing to take a stand to repudiate their debts. One big exception was Iraq. After the U.S. invasion and ouster of Saddam Hussein in 2003, American authorities managed to get some of the debt incurred by Hussein to be considered odious and forgiven. But this was a unique case. For the billions of people who suffered under colonialists or dictators and have since been forced to pay their debts plus interest, they have not gotten this special treatment. In recent years, the IMF has even acted as a counter-revolutionary force against democratic movements. In the 1990s, the fund was widely criticized on the left and the right for helping to destabilize the former Soviet Union as it descended into economic chaos and congealed into Vladimir Putin's dictatorship. In 2011, as the Arab Spring protests emerged across the Middle East, the Deauville Partnership with Arab Countries in Transition was formed and met in Paris. Through this mechanism, the bank and fund led massive loan offers to Yemen, Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, and Jordan, quote, Arab countries in transition, in exchange for structural adjustment. As a result, Tunisia's foreign debt skyrocketed, triggering two new IMF loans, marking the first time that the country had borrowed from the fund since 1988. The austerity measures paired with these loans forced the devaluation of the Tunisian dinar, which spiked prices. National protests broke out as the government continued to follow the fund playbook with wage freezes, new taxes, and, quote, early retirement in the public sector. 29-year-old protester Warda Atig summed up the situation, quote, As long as Tunisia continues these deals with the IMF, we will continue to struggle, she said. We believe that the IMF and the interest of people are contradictory. An escape from submission to the IMF, which has brought Tunisia to its knees and strangled the economy, is a prerequisite to bring about any real change. Part 7. Creating Agricultural Dependence.
The idea that developing countries should feed themselves is an anachronism from a bygone era. They could better ensure their food security by relying on the U.S. agricultural products, which are available in most cases at lower cost. Former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, John Block.
All right, we're going to stop here today. I'm out of time for recording here, and I've got some things to wrap up before the night, but I do want to say a couple of things. First off, let's pause for our sponsor, and we'll get a short guy's take. The fold card feels like cheating. It really kind of does. So this is my bank account. This is how I use it. This is my main fiat banking functionality. It is a debit card, not a credit card, a debit card that pays you sats back just for daily purchases, which you can do. You can spin the wheel and get like a random subset of, you know, rewards from, you know, 1%, 2%, 0.5%. 10%, up to 100%, and even a whole Bitcoin is on the wheel. I haven't hit that one yet, but I will let you know if I do. But you can either have fun and spin the wheel, that's kind of my thing, or you can just take a flat 1% on everything. Imagine every single bill, everything that you do in fiat, you could just get 1%, not pay an extra 1%, you just get 1% of it back in sats. And an important note is that you do not have tax liability on this as if you bought Bitcoin at this point. It is simply when you withdraw is your cost basis because it's set up as a reward rather than a purchase. So in the last week, my biggest stack, there's a really big one just a little bit further down, but that's not within the last week, was 64,753 sats. That's about $11.50 or so. If you do the fold card monthly, it only costs $10 a month. You can get it for less. It's $100 if you do it for a year. And you get 20,000 sats for free just if you go to my link to check out the app. Honestly, if you were in the US and you're not doing this, I gotta say, you need to think about it. Just by using this, not doing anything else, I have 0.15 Bitcoin in savings. I could very well end up with getting a whole coin out of just the fold card. I don't know, maybe that's a long shot, but I am certainly going to try.
So check them out. Go to my link, guyswan.com/fold. We'll redirect you over there. Get your 20,000 free sats. You don't have to give them a credit card or buy anything, nothing. Just go check out the app, download it, and you get 20,000 sats. And you donate 10,000 sats to the show. It's like an affiliate. That's pretty great. Helps me out too. That's like $2. Link in the show notes. All right. So the thing that, after hearing this onslaught of evidence and the unbelievable record of what the IMF and the World Bank has been doing and what the consequences of everything that they have been engaging in from a financial and monetary perspective in the third world and largely the global South. Honestly, I think if you, for someone who believes that this is not malicious, or in other words, that this is not explicitly on purpose, I have to ask, like, what is it that supposedly everybody in our era can't do anything for negative purposes? Or that somehow evil has been eradicated in the West because we're rich or something? Like I don't know. Like, is it just like, do we gaslight ourselves into thinking that, like, I know neighbors, like, I know people who are day to day, who lie all the time, who do things purely to benefit themselves, who lie to themselves about the situation, who explicitly hurt other people or pointlessly make something a contest that doesn't need to be a contest. They're always like thinking about the power struggle in relationships rather than actually just being with other people. Like, I know normal people day to day with no power, no situation, no political position, who are really kind of crappy people. Why would they not exist just a little bit higher up the ladder? Why would their focus, why would their lack of principles, why would their gaslighting and their self-lying and their greed and their interest in turning everything into a power struggle, everything into a position of who has control over who, why would that go away? Why would it not get exponentially worse? Why would they not all gaslight everyone that they're just trying to do stuff good? What is this childish belief? Where does this come from that we believe this fairy tale that our leaders can't be corrupt somehow? That finally, we're the quote-unquote good guys. And so anything that you can watch an institution support dictator after dictator after dictator after dictator, that at one after the other, a regime or a democratically elected leader or someone comes in to challenge the status quo, to challenge their position, and the number of them who get assassinated, who just mysteriously die within an incredibly short span of time, and then the person who replaces them suddenly is on board with everything again. Like, this, there's, at what point do you recognize that these aren't coincidences, that this is how governments work? This is the game that they play. These institutions have been doing this forever. They didn't suddenly become non-colonialist. They just found a PR tool so that they could make themselves look like the good guys and keep doing the same shit they always do. They're just doing it with the money instead of with direct political power. They're just cheating under the surface because they know that if they're really blatant about it, they're going to get called out. It's a lot harder to control the information, but all you have to do is come up with a simple-sounding excuse. Just, oh, we're just going to dismiss it. Oh, it's just an accident that we buried their country in debt, eviscerated their self-sustaining infrastructure, put in a bunch of crap that was profitable for us, put them in a deeply net negative monetary outflows, and supported a dictator who was killing tens of thousands of people. I don't understand why it's so hard. And I guess I do. That's so stupid. Like, I pretend that it's difficult to understand people, and it's not. You know, it is the age-old quote. I can't remember who the quote was, but that it's... Actually, I think it was Mark Twain. But that it's easier to fool people then convince them that they've been fooled.
And I guess, you know, you look at populations all around the world, even populations under dictators and just horrible governments. You know, they all have central education and, you know, government-run education, and they all teach their students, they all teach the population that their country is amazing, and, you know, the current regime is the one that came in and, you know, fixed everything, and they're the good guys, and they stop the bad guys and tell all the bad things about the previous regime or the previous system that was fixed, quote-unquote, by the good guys. If there was a story as old as time, it is that one. But it's incredible. And it makes me wonder, too, like, how do you think about, like, how do we frame today? Like, what's happening today and what's happening around Bitcoin and the political attacks? It's like there's a degree that I know, like, these institutions aren't just all in line. You know, it's not like it's one giant club that has one explicit goal and one very powerful and, like, very strict and, like, super loyal hierarchy that everybody's following some grand plan. Like, the very nature of the people who play the game this way, that think of everything in terms of power and one-upping someone and who do they control and how much influence they have, who are in that mindset and who desire, who achieve everything that they can to get power, to get influence over others. They don't have loyalties to each other. They don't. The last thing they want to do is be subservient to each other. So they're obviously always in conflict, but they also respond to power, which means they're going to do. I mean, this is why you have this story over and over again of dictators coming in power and then doing what the IMF and World Bank want to do, because their ambition to get power and control over their own population and in their own little corner of the world is that they have to be subservient to someone else. They want to be at the arm of the really big dog that they know can come in and basically handle everyone for them. And when the very real potential exists that these institutions for tens of billions and trillions of dollars are willing to assassinate, undermine, or oust opposing leaders, what are they aware of in the context of Bitcoin? Like, do they see it as a threat? Who among them would see it as a threat? How much of a threat do they see? What would be their plan of action, and who would they have influence over? And I think in light of this, this should give you a fresh perspective if you weren't aware of a lot of these facts and this history. It should give you a fresh perspective of what Nayib Bukele wrote in the Orange, Bright Orange Future edition of Bitcoin Magazine, and we read it very recently on the show. It was Stop Believing the Global Elites, I believe. Oof, I forgot what the title was. Oh, it was Stop Drinking the Elites' Kool-Aid by Nayib Bukele. And he talks about the reaction they had to their movement into Bitcoin and their issuing of Bitcoin-backed bonds. And it seems another great example of how they explicitly attack a nation simply because of their monetary position. And when there's actual success, like when you actually have a staggering decrease in the overall violence in the country and conditions improving, they're not seeking to benefit this. They're not seeking to support this. Instead, they downgrade the debt rating to as low as they can and essentially issue a threat to anyone trying to monetarily support them. At what point, how many times, and in how many situations does this have to occur over and over and over again to recognize, for it to be publicly known, for the information to get out there, and for the collective consciousness to wake up and realize that they don't give a shit about people? That none of this is about prosperity. None of this is about helping the third world or the global south or Latin America, poor nations, even in the slightest. This is a grift. It is a giant scam. And it is designed and supported for the very reasons of keeping the scam running. And one of the things that this article, Gladstein is just killing it with the research, because it's funny how many times I'm aware of a lot of the
pieces or kind of vague ideas. And maybe it's like that I've read some of these things in the past, like some of these details, and just kind of forgotten about them. And so they left an impression that, like, oh yes, I know the IMF and the World Bank lends out to dictators and they shut down and, you know, help engage in coups for regimes that are opposing to the desires of the IMF and the World Bank. I have that general idea, but I couldn't tell you like a list of them. I couldn't tell you the numbers. But when Gladstein breaks down the numbers, I had no idea, especially Hickel's piece, which I'm thinking of actually going back and just reading that one in its entirety. I've got it saved. Probably not doing audio. I think it's like really dry. I skimmed a little bit of it. But his detailing of the amount of debt that has been put into the third world, that has been pushed onto the third world and the developing world, and the amount of money extracted over the last 40 to 50 years. There's a quote. I saved a little section here. Okay, yeah, here it is. So to give an example of what this might look like in a given year, in 2012, developing countries received $1.3 trillion, including all income, aid, and investment. But that same year, more than $3.3 trillion flowed out. In other words, according to anthropologist Jason Hickel, developing countries sent $2 trillion more to the rest of the world than they received. When all the flows were added up from 1960 to 2017, a grim truth emerged. $62 trillion was drained out of the developing world. $62 trillion. Holy shit. I cannot fathom the amount of prosperity and capital that they could have created for themselves that got siphoned out of their continents. Like, you know, capital formation is incredibly difficult to sustain when you do not have strong property rights. In fact, it basically falls apart without strong property rights. If you do not have reliable and consistent government or governance, you can't create a market. The market essentially forms around the ability to establish a set of rules. If those rules are meaningless, if the property cannot be secured, then there is no market. And if there is no market, there's no prosperity. So it's easy to look at the developing world and see all the dictators and see all the corruption and say, oh, that's why they haven't been able to build themselves out of this. But how much of that only exists because of the World Bank and the IMF? How much of this exists systemically because of the system they are trying to keep propped up? How much of it has nothing at all to do with the desire of the actual people and their attempts to fix their communities and their countries, and has everything to do with the Western regime, the Western monetary powers that actively set up and push a system that supports the destruction of these very institutions because of what allows them to come in and control, and because of the staggering dollar amount that they benefit. And understand, this doesn't just hurt them, it hurts us too, because it pointlessly makes us interdependent on each other, not in like a healthy, sustainable trade agreement sort of way, where you have one group literally just trading with another group. It puts them in a position of dependency, and it puts us in a position of dependency pointlessly. It ruins our manufacturing. It guts our infrastructure base by exporting it to other nations to get cheap labor. You know, that's actually probably something. There's a read called The Capital Strip Mine by Alan Farrington, which might be a really good one to revisit. But I'll have the link in the show notes if you want to listen to it, because that is literally its own entire rabbit hole, basically, to understand how they've gutted the productive base of the U.S. economy through the manipulation of the credit system. But it's also really interesting. There's a perspective in this that was a little bit new to me. I'd never really thought about how colonialism tied into the Great Depression, how it tied into exactly how much excess wealth the
essentially many of the Western nations had, not merely because they outsource so much of their productive capacity, but more importantly is they use the monetary dynamics, they use the debt, the dynamics of issuing debt for other nations as a way to extract actual resources, like massive amounts of resources. And, you know, when you think of this in the terms of tens of billions and maybe even like $1 trillion or something like that, it's like, well, with the size of the overall economy, like you can see that having a factor, like it clearly plays in, but it's almost kind of a self-feedback loop, right? Is the size and power of the currency enables the extraction of the wealth because of the desire to use the currency. And in fact, you can actually, they're actually using that debt to destroy the local currency to further extend essentially the monetary network. So there's clearly this exorbitant privilege, you know, as it's called, the exorbitant privilege of the seigniorage of the global reserve currency, the idea that the United States, that the Federal Reserve, and preferentially all of the World Bank and the IMF institutions that have access to this capital, that they're essentially living on the backs of the countries they export their debt to. But the problem is this is so fundamental to how the system works. You know, it goes back to the idea of what are people in power going to do but abuse it? Like, they're going to use it in the ways that they can use it. And this is why the only real solution to the problem, it's not getting a better leader in power. It's not, you know, changing who's in charge of the power structure. It's fundamentally altering the access that power has. Fundamentally changing the system and the set of rules such that the power simply is not granted to anyone. This is why I think Bitcoin is the most important thing in the world right now. It is, without a doubt, because it can fundamentally change that relationship. It can alter the monetary structures of the world such that there is no seigniorage, there is no monetary power position to abuse. Now, people with influence, people with political power, will always be able to abuse trust relationships. They will always be able to abuse situations where you are forced to trust them. But money, the most important capital allocating tool on the face of the planet, will no longer be in that sphere. And think that this is one consequence. This is one major parasitic drain that is caused by the fundamental political nature of how our monetary system works, how the power in the monetary structure is. In 50 years, it was able to parasitically siphon $62 trillion out of the developing world. Think in aggregate the damage that this does, the misinformation that gets into every market, the manipulation of fundamental prices, of the price of time, of the price of interest, and the price of using up capital today that we need in the future. If $62 trillion, this is just one, this is not in aggregate, this is not the whole structure, just consider $62 trillion. If we were properly allocating it, if we were adjusting and reacting to the economic truth of the world, what could we not solve with $62 trillion in honest capital allocation and direction? And that's just a piece of the damage being done. Bitcoin is able to alter that power dynamic in a way never really done before in history. And to think that we are lucky enough to live through this time, to see this exposed and to see it as messy and as crazy as it is to watch unfold. God, what a crazy, crazy thing to be a part of. World's going to be a very, very different place in a couple of decades.
It's funny because it's going to sneak up on us. And it is, kind of. I feel like it is happening. Like, last few years, if they're any indication, things are changing fast. And that's why we do Bitcoin Audible. That's why we keep up on it. That's why we dig into all of it. And if you want the curated version of understanding just what's going on, all the really important things that are happening, and all the tools and technologies that are fundamentally changing it, well, holy crap, you came to the right place. My God, that's Bitcoin Audible. So we're going to close this out here. I had like 5 more quotes to hit, but I'm out of time. It's late as crap over here, and it's time to close this out. So I will wrap these into either tomorrow's notes or part 3's notes, or maybe even part 4 or a guy's take after. I don't know. There's a lot to cover with this stuff. So it will be something that we revisit, end of story. So don't worry. We'll come back to it. But with that, I'm thinking it's looking like right now this will be 4 parts to get this whole piece out. It could be 5. It just kind of depends on my recording time. But I am going to keep going. I'm going to try to stay on the grind and get this piece out, hopefully before the end of the week. So wish me luck, and I will catch you tomorrow with another episode of Bitcoin Audible. Don't forget to check out our amazing sponsors. Don't forget to check out the Fold Card, and Swan. The Fold Card for your fiat life, so you can stack sats like mad. Swan, so you can onboard into Bitcoin, learn everything you need to learn, and stack automatically. And Cold Card and CoinKite, so you can keep that crap safe. And lucky you, we got lots of little goodies and some special links and discounts right there in the show notes. I hope you're enjoying this one as much as I am, and I'll catch you back here tomorrow with another episode of Bitcoin Audible. I'm Guy Swan, and until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. It's easier to fool people than to convince them that they have been fooled. Mark Twain.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.